I'm Jennifer Dudley, and this is Fascinating Ordinary, where we get curious about everyday things that are actually amazing.
We're so glad you're here with us. Jennifer, which rabbit hole are we going down today?
Well, I'm going to be bringing you down this cheesy rabbit hole that I have built for myself and now you.
Okay.
But before we get there, I just want to let our listeners know and remind you that I am wearing a mask today because I have had a cold. And, you know, Abby and I had a talk about do we prize the quality of our sound recording or Jennifer's voice in the sound recording more or Abby's health more? And
we didn't really talk about it. It's true. Just sort of assumed. Yeah. You just led yes. with.
Jennifer in order made to keep a decision. Abby healthy, yes, exactly.
I'm going to wear a mask today, which I am very grateful for. But we also tested it and played with it, and we're pretty sure that, well, I can hear you really well even through it. So if Jennifer sounds muffled, it's not because I'm keeping her captive in a small room in the library. That is also true, yes. But she's keeping me safe. So that's thanks right. to Jennifer for that.
Yeah. So now, Abby, I would like to ask you, do you have a favorite cheese?
I think you need to give me context on this.
Oh, I love that answer. Oh, man. Okay. Do you have a favorite cheese that you could eat either by itself or, like, just with a cracker?
That does not narrow it down.
Ooh, okay.
Don't you just eat every cheese by itself or just on
No, there are several cheeses that, like, well, yes, true. I could, okay. yeah. but I really prefer it,
yeah.
you know.
So there's a wild mushroom brie at Trader Joe's that's really good on burgers, for example, but I do not care for it by itself.
Oh, okay.
So, yes, I will put that on a burger any day, but I will not eat it plain.
Okay, so what's one that, like, you could eat on, you know, like, on different kinds of foods or in different kinds of foods and by itself? Like, this is your all-star cheese.
Like, my go-to kind of a cheese? Okay. I'm really having trouble picking a favorite. It's like children. but I think, like, a go-to for me would be a not very funky brie.
Oh, okay.
Aldi has a camembert, which is camembert? I don't know how to say it without the Danish accent. So it's just camembert in my mind.
Yeah.
Is that English? Is that right?
I pronounce it camembert. That's how I've heard it. But I'm fine with Danish.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'll just do something funky with the last syllable. And that's because I've only ever heard it in a Danish context. Yeah. Okay. So camembert is the... Aldi has a non-funky camembert, which I think camembert is supposed to be more funky than brie.
Yes.
But Aldi's camembert is less funky than most places' brie. And I don't love funky cheese. Like, I can eat it, and especially when it's, like, really funky goat cheese and chicken. Like, chicken breast wrapped around goat cheese or something like that. I'm so hungry. This was a terrible idea for a podcast. I'm going to be so hungry when I finish this.
I brought snacks just in case.
Oh, you did? Yeah. I thought about bringing cheese, but then I was like, where am I going to put it?
Yeah.
And I don't think we're supposed to eat it here.
No, we're definitely not.
If
so,
you're in the Hesburgh Library and you're listening to us, we are not eating.
We are not eating
right now.
And I didn't bring snacks.
No. So the camembert that's not too funky is more preferable to me than the brie because it's less funky.
Wow.
So
okay.
Less funky brie / camembert.
Yeah. So what my goal for today is to get you to describe that in even, like, more specific language. Because
are we doing, sommelier kind of
notes
of
in a way, yeah, exactly.
Kind of okay.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, funky can mean a lot of things. Just like a lot of people describe cheeses as sharp. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they could be picking up on quite a few qualities.
Interesting.
So we will definitely get into, like, tasting notes. That's something that I have planned for later.
Oh,
and then,
good. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm so curious.
But yeah, like, I'm excited about this topic. I love cheese. I think cheese is very ordinary in the sense that it's everywhere. It's been a staple of human diets. Some, not all, of course, for, like, human societies since before we were writing down our history.
Mm.
Like, cheese is important to people in a lot of different ways, you know, like, as a livelihood, as just, like, a way to gather and, like, in, you know, charcuterie boards have become a thing in our culture that are a way for people to share and gather and enjoy each other's company and food.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an important piece of celebration for us. And
it's a very functional food, which I appreciate about it. Like, It's got enough protein that I can easily give a cheese stick to my daughter as a snack and be like, cool, done for the day. It's got enough salt that as someone with a heart condition, I can eat oodles of it and be like, yay, I'm hitting my health goals for the day, right? Like, things like that. It's a really wonderful functional food in addition to being, like, a beautiful part of our life. So very fascinating, very ordinary, but also very, like, ethereal in its prowess.
Yeah. Well, so the other goal for me today is to convince you and our listeners to try some new cheeses. Cheese in America and American cheese separately were looked down on for like hundreds of years. Like while France and England and Switzerland were crafting cheeses that had like all of this personality and beauty and like variety, America was pumping out mass-produced singles for like a very long time.
Mass-produced singles like the pieces of cheese wrapped in a piece of plastic, wrapped in another piece of plastic.
Exactly.
Those do make the best grilled cheese sandwiches.
They absolutely do, yes. And that's because of their melting qualities. But, you know, this isn't the end of the American cheese story. We have a vibrant artisan cheese market with widely available cheeses that even, like, from the most adventurous to the least adventurous palate can enjoy. And we have gone from craft American singles to winning the world championship of cheese. Like how an American cheese.
An American like American cheese or a cheese from America?
A cheese from America.
That makes more sense to me.
And so the French scoffed. Yes. But, you know, our cheese was the best that year. So I think it's just the 1 year, and we can talk about that more later.
Did you say your favorite kind of cheese yet?
No.
I got really excited when you started telling me all this stuff, but like, hold on, back up. What's your favorite kind of cheese?
For me, it is context specific. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's not that I have a favorite kind of cheese. It's that I have a favorite cheese that I will mix into like a mac and cheese.
Okay. Yeah.
Like you said, grilled cheeses are great with American, but I really like a grilled cheese that also has, like, it needs a melty, maybe American style, but it also needs, like, a hint of blue and a hint of cheddar. To me, that makes just a phenomenal grilled cheese. Some of the brie that I like, I will eat with a spoon. You know, other things I think need to be put on a cracker and so on. There's a cheese that comes out every... There's actually quite a few holiday cheeses in America. Because cheeses have seasons. And so, you know, there's some of those that I look forward to every year. There's one cheese, Rush Creek Reserve, that has hints of bacon.
Interesting.
Yes.
Okay.
And it's the kind of thing that I can eat one piece of, and I need to eat one piece of every year because I look forward to it so much. Yeah. But it's so... like overwhelming, like the flavor is so big and bold that I just can't eat a lot of it. Oh my gosh, I can't wait to get into all of the like tasting and the kinds, but first I wanted to give you like a tiny slice of history. And the history of cheese is a huge topic, so I want to keep it somewhat narrow because we could talk for days about it. But then, so a little bit of history, a hint of science, and then on to like how to taste cheese, expand your palate, try new things, and open yourself up to what I think is actually a very accessible world, but seems from the outside, I think, overwhelming to a lot of people. Probably not you, because you are pretty adventurous.
It did, though. Okay. This is the story of how I fell in love with cheese. My very best friend since I was like 7 years old is an incredible chef and baker. And I had not really experimented with cheese much. Like mozzarella and cheddar were always in our house. I think we used them for a lot of cool things. But like I had not really ventured beyond that world until maybe high school. She started using it for all sorts of things. And she made this one grilled cheese sandwich that had green apple and brie and onion powder, which is like a staple in the Midwest, right? And like a bunch of other things, but it was just the most delicious thing ever. And that sandwich was the I need to learn more about the world of cheese. But it is really overwhelming. And I will also say, I thought for a long time it was really expensive. Because when I heard about cheese plates or I saw charcuterie boards, this is less common in the last few years, but like they were on rich people's plates. They were on like fancy dinner parties where you had to wear a dress that you'd never worn before and you'd never wear again yeah. kind of a thing, right? But actually, the variety of cheeses that are at Aldi, which mm-hmm. is a really reasonably priced grocery store, for those of you who do not know, where you can get a can of black beans for 68 cents, or like the number of really cool cheeses that are at your local grocer that are actually mm-hmm. really price effective is incredible. You can get a huge amount of exposure in the world of cheese without having a budget that allows for, you know, a one-time party cocktail dress. So once I realized that, I fell in love with cheese yeah. and I started making it a normal part of my daily food, a normal part of my weekly food run. So yeah. like, I'm going to try a new cheese.
Yeah. I think that's a really good message for anyone who has thought about getting into cheese, or anyone who, you know, listens to the episode and thinks like, yeah, maybe I'll try something new, but is worried about that, yeah. about the price points.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not the warning. What's the positive version of a warning?
Surprise?
Yeah, that's the surprise. Yeah.
Good news.
Good news. This is actually quite accessible, like, financially.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can make it accessible, like, mentally and emotionally today.
Right.
If it feels overwhelming.
Which is incredible. But this is also partially, I think, because there's been so much time that we've yeah. had in the world to develop cheese and make it the things we want to make it. I guess that's not necessarily true. Like, wine feels less accessible to me, and wine's been around for forever. Is wine or cheese? Which one came first?
I can't. That's a good question. I am not prepared to answer.
That's
actually a great segue. I know that there is evidence of cheese making in ancient Egypt around 3000 BCE, as well as the Libyan Sahara as early as 5000 BCE. But there's been like some evidence to suggest people had cheese like even earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time we get to the Roman Empire, like, cheesemaking is a whole industry. It's, like, truly a staple.
I remember reading that, like, the Romans had cheesemaking rooms in their houses. Like, if you mm-hmm. were rich, you had, like, a separate room. And I remembered that from, like, second grade history class. So I did Google to make sure that is correct. And yeah. it is actually correct that, like, many of the rich Romans had an entire room in their house devoted solely to making cheese.
Yeah, because it is a fantastically efficient way to store calories for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so at a time when, you know, having extra was important, not like now when having extra means nothing to people. I'm being sarcastic.
Okay. I was not catching up.
No. You know, excess is a status symbol now, mm-hmm. and excess was a status symbol then. And so mm-hmm. being able to store extra calories obviously indicated that you had enough resources, whatever the case is. But also, cheese is a really stable way to move calories around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, where other forms of food might not make it, you know, like, you can't transport soup across thousands of miles right. and expect it to stay good. Cheese, you can.
I have another random thing that I know that's relevant here. It's also a very space effective way mm-hmm. because the amount of milk you need to the amount of cheese you create is a 10-to-1 ratio.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of, like, moving, you know, 10 gallons worth of milk when you've got a camel is a little bit more intimidating than the idea of moving, like, one wheel of cheese. So that idea that it's yeah. easy to transport seems to be a volume issue in addition to being, yeah. like, a stability issue, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's the theory of how cheese was made. Like, someone somewhere came up with the idea, and I'll say the book that I read the theory in was American Cheese by Joe Berkowitz.
Okay.
And I don't think Joe Berkowitz presented this as like, this is the fact of the first time cheese was made, but mm-hmm. rather truly like, this is the theory or hypothesis that someone was transporting milk across a desert, and they were doing so by camel, and they were storing it in some sort of gut, like a sheep gut or a camel gut or something like that, and that was hanging off the side of the camel, and the jostling that would happen as a camel moved would be enough to cut the curd, the like enzymes inside of the gut that it was being stored in
mm-hmm.
would be enough to like curdle and help like not age the cheese, but, you know, it mature the cheese enough so that it was cheese instead of milk or just curds and whey. But mm-hmm. there would have been, whatever they're pulling out of the bag would have been curds and right. whey. And right. curds is where cheese starts.
So that happened, like, multiple places in the world, presumably at different times or the same so. Time or, like,
yeah.
okay.
Yeah, I don't even know if they know. Like,
yeah.
They, what I didn't get, and this is probably a very fascinating story, is, like, this sort of political economy of cheese.
Right.
I would love to know more. I did see that there was a discussion somewhere about, like, cheese being introduced to Asia, mm-hmm. And so that would have been via trade routes.
Mm-hmm.
But, obviously, like, it didn't stick there in right. the way that it did in other places.
So what about the U.S.? Because we're both in the U.S. context. So, yeah. like, did it... Did someone discover it in the U.S. separately of the other places you've mentioned, Egypt and Libya and things like that?
Yeah. Cheese was actually introduced by Puritan dairy farmers. And so in the 17th century, English Puritan dairy farmers brought their knowledge of dairy farming and cheese making with them from the Old World to the new English colonies. And very quickly started, like, manufacturing as opposed to just, you know, shipping cheese from the Old World to the New World. Mm-hmm. They started manufacturing. And one of the things that isn't talked about in a lot of the books and articles that I read is how enslaved women were a huge part of dairy manufacturing mm-hmm. in, like, the early part of American history. So these women would be in charge of the dairy, like where the cow, you know, the milking of the cows and the keeping of the cows, and they would also be in charge of making cheese. So there's a woman named Eleanor Eldridge, who is an acclaimed cheesemaker.
Mm-hmm.
She was born in Rhode Island and was the daughter of an Indian woman and a formerly enslaved man who bought his freedom by fighting in the Revolutionary War, to mm-hmm. give you some sense of, like, when this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And after her mother died when she was a child, she went to work as a servant where she learned to make cheese and then worked in a dairy to support herself.
Mm-hmm.
And actually fought, like, a landmark legal case in which she successfully sued to reclaim the house she owned, which had been seized by a lender. And, like, there's a memoir written about her. Like, she, it, like, stands out in the record for being, like, a freed Black woman in the 1800s who made high-quality cheeses. Like, she mm-hmm. had the skill that she learned and used it to, like, maintain her independence.
Yeah.
So.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
What kind of cheese was she making?
I mean, it would have been, like, probably a basic farmer's cheese.
Okay.
It wouldn't have been, like this is something that I didn't read into, which is surprising. That's something I should have.
Well, but there may not be records of it, too. I was just curious if you knew.
No. So, yeah, like, given the time and the place, I think at that time, Monterey cheese had been invented, but that was in California, and mm-hmm. Colby cheese had been invented by then, but that was in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And so she would have been making cheeses that were probably, like, the knowledge of them would have come from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it could have been something close to a cheddar.
Did cheddar come from the UK?
Yeah, I think that was
interesting.
Yeah, okay. like an English thing.
Yeah.
Cheeses were very regional up until, like, really recently.
Yeah.
Like, in England, they made things like cheddar. In Switzerland, they made things like alpines and
Swiss,
like Gruyere, Swiss. Yeah, yes, Swiss cheese.
Denmark made Havarti.
Denmark made Vardy.
Havarti. It's very important.
Yes.
Havarti's.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then France, even though France made a lot of cheeses that were very specific to France, they actually, like, they did have a wider variety than most countries, I think, mm-hmm. for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But now they have something like 1,600 cheeses.
Okay.
Like, different varieties of cheese.
Yeah.
Even then, most Europeans feel constrained by the authentication rules.
Mm.
Like, you know, for something to be Gruyere, it has to be very specific. And, like, the French aren't allowed to make Gruyere because of the, like, European rules around authentication. Like, PDO labels, things like that.
Got it. But so if that's overwhelming to you, remember, if it tastes good, you get to eat it.
Yes. Yeah.
You don't need to know all this stuff.
That's right.
To enjoy cheese. I'm really fascinated by this. But next time you're at the grocer's and you're like, oh, goodness, I wanted a Swiss one. Which one is it? Just look at the one that says Swiss.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it, I mean, a lot of them might say Swiss. Pick the one that looks good. Like, this is a place where it's okay to judge a book by its cover.
Yeah.
Like, pick the one that looks good to you.
Do you ever smell the outsides of the wrappers?
Absolutely.
I do, too. Yeah. Just to see.
And I get annoyed when they're so well wrapped that I can't smell.
Yeah. I feel like that also is a little bit more hygienic, so there's that. So, you brought up Wisconsin, which is very near and dear to my heart. And Colby was invented there. And we're talking about all these other places that are all inventing cheese, but I'm really curious about the way that we get in the U.S. from, like, cheese being something that was brought to the U.S. to then, apparently, we won a national championship.
Yeah.
International championship.
Yeah, international championship. Yeah, that's right. We developed national competitions so that we could start showing off of our skills.
Okay, and then we migrated to the international
International stage. Yeah, so this kind of got started, I mean, I will say Americans and American women had a heavy hand in, like, developing the cheese industry and, like, developing new cheeses in the U.S. for, like, most of its history. But it was around the 1980s that a group of women that are affectionately referred to as the Goat Ladies started a chèvre movement that would eventually be, like, Laura Chenille. I'm going to be honest, I've only ever read her name. I've never heard anyone say it.
Fair. So, disclaimer.
Don't go, like, if anyone tells you, oh, it's not Laura Chenille or Chenille, then that's
my bad. Or let's just
bad.
All say it's Chenille, and if there are enough of us who just say it's that one, that'll be it.
Oh, good idea.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
But
side question, since we're talking about things we don't know.
Yeah.
How do you say chèvre?
Like that, basically.
Just chèvre?
Like, yeah.
And what is chèvre?
It's a goat cheese.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
so
actually
it's
a fresh
goat
cheese. Yeah.
Has to be fresh.
Yeah, it wouldn't be an aged goat cheese.
Okay.
Like, the chèvre refers to the freshness and also the source, like the milk.
Okay.
So that would be a fresh goat cheese. Yeah.
And from my perspective, all the chèvres I've ever had have been things you use a knife to spread.
Yeah.
Not things you use a knife to cut. Are there other important things our listeners should know about chèvre?
It's very malleable in that it takes flavors on really nicely. So if you go to your Trader Joe's, your Whole Foods, your Aldi, your Kroger, you will absolutely see one that has dill on it or blueberries on it or something like that. And those are all really valid and delicious ways to eat it.
Yeah, I had it with fig once. That was really
good. Yeah. It is a really excellent pairing cheese.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which lends itself well to, you know, the goat ladies getting a band together and making a cheese together.
Yeah.
Well, they pick the one that, of course, is...
So they didn't ever... I mean, they may have ever gotten together, but, like...
Oh, so these are separate people.
Yeah.
The goat ladies were not actually, like, a band.
Yeah. No.
Okay.
A band of cheesemakers.
That makes me a little sense.
So there's Laura, there's Mary Keene of Cypress Grove, Allison Hooper of Vermont Creamery. All of these women in their separate dairies started making, like, a French-style goat cheese, and it, like, took off, like, demand in their various areas. Yeah, in the 1980s, they were making these cheeses, and they were producing for their local areas. So Laura Chenille and
Mary
Keene of Cypress Grove were both working out of California. Allison Hooper was at Vermont Creamery in Vermont. And they started getting picked up by, like, restaurants in the areas and, like, local shops in the areas. And demand really just skyrocketed so that eventually grocery stores wanted them. And so you can go, you can probably find, I know you can find Laura Chenille, like, at Martin's here near us, which is a grocery store. In our, like, that's, like, a local chain in our area. Kroger has some of these. Like, if you get to a Kroger that has, like, a good cheese counter, some of them have better cheese counters than others. You'll see some of these cheeses. But the like artisan cheese making became a thing. Like as demand skyrocketed, other dairies realized like, oh, people other than just like the locals in our neighborhood might be interested in this. Mm-hmm. The fun thing, like Joe Berkowitz of American Cheese points out that a lot of people in the cheese business caught the bug early and were always interested in cheese. Mm-hmm. But weirdly, a lot of people took like a sharp left turn somewhere in their lives and got pulled away from some other trajectory and into the cheese world. Mm. And so a lot of fine artisan cheeses are either produced by or sold by people that came to love cheese.
Interesting.
And like it is their passion.
Yeah. And there's just something about seeing people do their passion, right? There's something about, yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, that's really cool. I love that.
And so I think that was the story of Rogue Creamery was like a sharp left turn somewhere. But Rogue Creamery in Oregon made a cheese that was the best cheese in America in 2003.
Okay.
And that was called Rogue River Blue.
Okay.
Then the next thing that happened in this story is sometime around 2017, I went to Portland for a conference.
Okay.
This was the Pacific Sociology Association conference. And my husband and I went out for drinks and a cheese plate at a place called Cheese Bar.
Cool.
Which I had every intention of recommending to, like, whoever you are in Oregon, if you're going to Oregon or, like, the Portland area, mm-hmm. like, go to Cheese Bar. It's amazing. But it didn't quite survive the pandemic.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The owner, who was absolutely passionate about this, realized that he could either, like, keep doing this well or he could, like, take care of his body and his mental health and, you know, like...
Good for them.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's permanently closed, but Portland has no shortage of places to go for cheese, so there's that. But anyway, so Kevin and I went to the Cheese Bar, and there is a place, there I had the best blue cheese that I had ever had in my life, and I text my cheesemonger. My favorite cheesemonger is Kia of Cheesemongers of Sherman Oaks, and... Like, more on her later, for sure. More on Cheesemongers of Sherman Oaks later. This is not an advertisement for them. She doesn't know that I'm talking them up. But, like, man. If you're in the Sherman Oaks area, you have to go there. So I text her and was like, I'm eating this blue cheese. It's called Rogue River Blue. Like, can you get it in the shop, like, down there in California? And she was like, I don't know. I'll look into it. I don't dislike blues, but after tasting a lot of blues, I realized that there's an exact quality that I don't like in blue cheese, which is a lot of ammonia.
Okay.
And so Rogue River Blue is not very ammonia-y. It's like very creamy. It's complex without being overwhelming. Like it's really a wonderful blue cheese. So 2 years later, Rogue River Blue won 2019's Best Cheese in the World.
No way. That's awesome.
And I get to say I knew it before it was a champ.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah.
So,
Okay.
No, it's like this was a chance for like American cheese, as in cheese made in America, to really be taken much more seriously, like on the world stage, but also at home. And so along this road of these artisan cheese markets becoming important to people, being featured in restaurants, becoming available in like national grocery stores, all of a sudden there's this demand for like new and different and interesting cheeses. People have favorites. They get excited when they see their favorites at their store. They get disappointed when they're, you know, fresh out of that cheese. And so, like, this is just, like, a great time to develop a cheese hobby.
Yeah.
There's also a ton of, like, communities online. There's, like, a cheese party every year in Philadelphia by invite only, I'm told.
Oh, my.
So, yeah, this, you know, cheese is fantastic.
It is. And I also want to highlight that Jennifer has a cheesemonger, and I do not. So if you do not have a cheesemonger, that is okay. Like, there's so many ways to get into cheese just at a local grocery store. You don't have to have an invite to the Philadelphia party. No. Like, once again, this is a really accessible thing, I think. Mm-hmm. And I want to highlight that because there's so many foods where once it diversifies like this, when artisanal value becomes really high, then it becomes less accessible to most people. And while that's definitely true to some extent with everything, I think it's less true of cheese than it is of other things. Like, I think cheese mm-hmm. is a much more universal and kind of welcoming hobby to get into mm-hmm. For everybody rather than, and maybe that's because of all the stories of women and black women mm-hmm. and, like, maybe that's part of it. I'm not really sure, but mm-hmm. anyway, yeah. Okay, so you brought up blue cheese. Mm-hmm. Which I don't particularly care for. I haven't tried that one. I really do want to now. Mm-hmm. Do you have a cheesemonger in South Bend who could get me a little taste of that?
We would have to go to Whole Foods and ask them if they can get it. Actually, Whole Foods might carry it. The rule at Whole Foods is that all of the cheeses they need to carry have to be available in all of their stores. Mm-hmm. That didn't used to be the case before Amazon bought Whole Foods.
And if you're friends with Jennifer, she's told you this story like 8 times. Yeah. And it's really frustrating to her. So if you want to know more about this, email us and Jennifer will tell you the entire story of Amazon and Whole Foods and what it did to the cheese offerings. But good to know. Yes. I'm cutting you off on that because we don't need to to go down that rabbit hole right now.
And we don't want to make enemies of Amazon or Whole Foods, for sure.
But they might have Rogue River Blue. That's good to know. Okay, so blue cheese. I don't particularly care for it. One of the reasons I think it's too funky, like I said before, I don't really like funky mm-hmm. cheese very much. But it brings up the biggest remaining question that I have about cheese, mm-hmm. which is not one you need to answer, but I am really curious for us mm-hmm. to talk about it. Mold is a part of how you make cheese.
Yes.
I don't really understand that. So this might go more broadly to a discussion about like how you make cheese, but one specific question I have about the process of making cheese is like, why is some mold bad? Mm-hmm. Like if there's white on a strawberry, that's a problem. Mm-hmm.
If and there's white on a cheese, just scrape it off, just so you know.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. With cheese, some mold is bad.
Right.
And I would say if you see green or black mold on your cheese, throw it away. Some mold is tolerable in that if you bring cheese home and you see a little bit of white mold on it, you scrape that off.
Okay.
And the rest of your cheese is absolutely fine to eat.
Okay.
And some mold is absolutely necessary in that, like, this is how the cheese is made. So, like, to make cheese, you start by introducing cultures to milk. So already, like,
you're starting with mold.
Yeah, the bacteria separates the, like, milk into its parts, the curd and the whey, mm-hmm. and some liquid, you know, some water or, like discard.
And this is essentially the process that happens if you've ever left out a cup of coffee with milk in it for too long.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
The same exact thing is happening.
Then you coagulate. So you can add rennet or rely on naturally occurring lactic acid bacteria to like coagulate the curds and the whey so that you can then ladle or cut the curd away from the whey.
So essentially it's like making it more substantive. It's bringing together the creamy parts and leaving out the watery parts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And this whey is like when you hear about like whey protein shakes, like a lot of things have whey in them. This is the byproduct of making cheese. There's also, I'm just going to insert here, there's a wonderful product called Yay Toast. That is not cheese because it's made of whey, but it's caramelized whey.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's so good. I recommend Yay Toast. It's spelled like G-J-E-T-O-S-T.
Okay.
It's pronounced Yay Toast. I could tell you it's a Norwegian, they call it a cheese, but again, it's made from whey. It's not made from curd, so it's technically not a cheese. And I could tell you stories about Yay Toast, but like we'll save that for another time. You take you get rid of the whey, and then the thing you do with the curd is now going to decide what kind of cheese you have. So
does the milk matter at all, though?
Absolutely. I mean,
like sheep versus goat versus cow.
Yeah.
It's like a pretty fundamental first decision.
Right? Yes. So I will get into more later how the milks matter. But for right now, I'll just say, like, you take a milk. What kind of milk It is absolutely matters. I think even for how you're going to handle it, because like some milks have more lactose than others. Mm-hmm. So they're going to, you know, you're going to treat it like a little bit differently, but the mm-hmm. process remains sort of the same. Like mm-hmm. you do some stuff, you get the curd. Now, whether you ladle out like whole pieces of curd, mm-hmm. which might become mozzarella, or whether you like cut and press the curd, mm-hmm. Which might become a cheddar, mm-hmm. like that process is going to matter, but it's still the same thing. Mm-hmm. So you'll drain the curd from the whey, you will add mold so that you can introduce like certain flavors or certain like processes that will happen. Like, you know, mold will eat through your lactose, mm-hmm. you know, at different rates, you know, in different, you know, and leave different byproducts. You're going to introduce salt. Like these processes remain the same for like whatever kind of cheese you're making. Mm-hmm. So that if you go look at a package of cheese, like what are the ingredients of this cheese and can it tell me what anything about the flavor or like what I'm going to be eating? Mm-hmm. They're all the same. Mm. They all say like milk or cheese curd and salt and rennet. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. You could be looking at a mozzarella or you could be looking at a 5-year cheddar mm-hmm. and it's going to have the same ingredients. So the big changes that happen in sort of the ripening or maturing process, mm-hmm. how you handle it, what other like molds you introduce. There's a class of cheese called washed rinds where the cheese maker will wash the cheese in beer or wine mm-hmm. or some other liquid mm-hmm. and that allows certain kinds of molds to form on the outside. Mm-hmm. And so that affects the flavor and the smell and the texture of the cheese. And, you know, like all of those different cheeses that you see, some of them look like little brains. Some of them look like blocks. There's a fantastic mm-hmm. cheese called Mimolette, which is a big liar. It looks like a cantaloupe on the outside. If you cut it open, it looks like the sharpest cheddar you've ever seen. It's bright orange, and it tastes so mild.
Huh.
You're expecting like a you know, the cheese to bite back when you eat it, and it's just so mild.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I know Aldi definitely has the wine washed ones on a regular basis, mm-hmm. so that's a good place to go if you're looking to try that. But if you are like, huh, this is really interesting, I would like to try a Mimolette, or I would like to try this Chevre thing, or I'm curious about Havarti, what is the first step that we should recommend for somebody who wants to start to enjoy cheese more or get a little bit more curious about the different fascinating ordinary kinds of cheese?
Step one to me really is just eat it as much as you can, as often as you can. No joke. Cheese is a living food. It has a lot of personality. It has seasons. Different batches of the same cheese could be, you know, more bitter, more vegetal, more lactic. Like, they'll have these different flavor profiles, and it'll be the same cheese. Mm-hmm. And so I truly believe if you want to enjoy more cheese or get to know more cheese, you just have to taste it. Mm-hmm. And so it was at Cheesemongers of Sherman Oaks where I learned how to taste cheese. So this is all pre-pandemic. My cheesemonger, Kia, and her husband, Tyler, own this cheese shop. And they would host cheese classes. And I should specify, this is for eating, not for making.
Okay, yeah.
So something like 10 people would gather around this like beautifully set table. There would be a plate with, I want to say, up to 8 cheeses. I think it was like between 6 and 8 cheeses, depending on the class. And they would all be in some theme. It was so cool. And so like for about a year around 20, or a little more than a year around 2016, I tried so many different cheeses and I took notes on all of them.
Really? Do they have an app for this? Because they have this app for beer, they have this app for wine. They gotta have this app for cheese.
They do now, and I haven't started using it. But I looked into it, and yes, there is a cheese app. Le Cheese. It's called L-E-C-H-E-E-S-E. So there is an app if you would like to keep track of your cheeses, which is basically what I was doing. I would take note of, like, what the cheeses looked like, what they smelled like, what they tasted like.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure because you had all of that exposure to all those different kinds of cheese, you started to figure out, like, oh, I like these better than this. I don't like high ammonia. High ammonia blue cheese.
Yeah.
So you like that less, right? So, like, you were able to figure this out through a lot of exposure and through, like, meticulous note-taking, I'm sure, as well. if somebody wanted to start with that and they're like, ah, it doesn't really sound like I like necessarily an ammonia. Like, that doesn't sound good to me. Like, what sorts of cheeses should they be looking for? I guess another way to ask this question is, what kinds of things in the cheese-making process affect what the cheese is going to taste like?
Yeah. So I'm going to recommend two things. One is this book called The Book of Cheese, The Essential Guide to Discovering Cheeses You'll Love by Liz Thorpe.
Okay.
She does a fantastic job of talking about the things that affect the taste of a cheese, but also breaking down the kinds of cheese that you might taste into flavor profiles. Mm-hmm. And she basically says there are these gateway cheeses, like maybe you like mozzarella.
Mm-hmm.
If you like mozzarella, here are some other cheeses in that family that you can try.
So Netflix for cheese.
Exactly. Yes. So most people talk about cheese types in terms of, like, country, milk type, or and style, meaning like pressed or bloomy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to switch it up a little bit and talk about it a little more in the way Liz Thorpe does, and also a little more in the way I came to understand it. So country is basically useless. Like,
country? Like, yeah, which country the cheese is from.
Exactly. Specifically because several countries have started producing hundreds, if not thousands, of varieties of cheeses.
Mm-hmm.
So saying that a cheese is from America doesn't really mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
So things that are useful, I think the milk. There's cow, sheep, goat, and buffalo,
mm-hmm.
and there are other, you know, like other kinds of milks that you'll get, but something like 1% of cheese made is from something other than cow, sheep, goat, and buffalo.
Got it. What percent is buffalo?
Oh, gosh. It's like 5.
Really?
Yeah.
It's higher than I expected.
Yeah. It's not a lot. The milk matters because of the animal, but mm-hmm. then also, like, what the animal is eating. So, like, goat cheese is bright white because goats process out the beta carotene from the grass that they eat,
okay.
where, like, cows and sheep don't.
Mm.
So cows and sheep will produce yellow milk.
Interesting.
And goats produce white milk,
okay.
or white cheese. And so, like, spring milk or fall will matter. Like, if the goats or cows or sheep or buffalo were eating spring grass,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be different than if they were eating, like, grass in other times of year, or, like, hay, or whatever the case is that goats and cows eat. In Switzerland, they bring about 130,000 cows up the mountains to graze in the Alpines every summer. And those cows spend 3 months grazing on the grasses and wildflowers that are only found in this area of the Alpines, and produce the milk for, like, Alpine cheese making. And it, like, has to be cows eating that grass in that area.
Isn't this the entire premise of Heidi?
I don't know. I've never watched Heidi.
It's a book.
I'm pretty sure it's also a movie.
I have not. Yeah, it is.
Okay.
I have not read it in a really long time, but I am, like, very sure that this is the entire premise of Heidi.
Oh, is the journey, I guess, that she takes to bring the cows up?
No, but she's in love with a goat herd.
Oh, wow.
Or, like, the goat herd's in love with her. I don't remember.
Oh, okay.
Huh. Yep.
All right.
It's a really odd book. I do not know if I recommend it. A lot of people really love it, but, like, it's a very violent book. It's a very ableist book. It's a very strange. Anyway, the moral of the story is Heidi gets stronger because of the goat's milk from the Alpines and this goat herd who brings goats around so that they can make cheese. That's my book review.
That's a great review. Okay,
so yeah. So I've heard of this before. The like idea that certain areas need to be used in order to make certain kinds of cheeses. Yeah. But if you don't necessarily care where your cow that made your milk ate wildflowers.
Yeah, then that is fine too. I mean, you can get good cheese from cows from anywhere. But the terroir.
Terroir.
So, yeah, so it's like the flavor of the place where the cheese comes from is absolutely considered to matter.
Okay.
So the process of making cheese, whether you're using like, whether you're doing a fresh cheese, as I said, which like wouldn't be aged, a pressed cheese, like a cheddar, a bloomed cheese, like a brie or a camembert, or a washed rind. But the place where they're made matters so much for the flavor. Mm. So there's a group, I'm pretty sure this is a real story. Cowgirl Creamery was in Point Reyes and wanted to move their cheese cave to somewhere nearby. And the cheeses made in the new spot were different.
Mm.
Like, even though the process was the same, the milk was the same, mm-hmm. the cows were the same. But, like, because the location where the cheese was aging was different, the flavor of the cheese was affected.
That makes sense.
And so then also the age of the cheese, like, from Liz Thorpe, an unaged sheep cheese and a two-year-aged sheep cheese might as well be a different milk type because the flavor difference is so dramatic.
Okay. And what is that usually? Like, does the older it gets, is it sharper? The older it gets, it's funkier? The older it gets,
I mean, that's going to depend on all the other things.
Okay.
Like, the sharpness, the funkiness, things like that. I will say aging seems to concentrate flavors.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a cheese that is going to be, like, sweet,
mm-hmm.
Like, Gouda has a sweet quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that pudgy, not the smoked Goudas mm-hmm. that have, like, a meaty flavor because of the smoke. But, like, you know, the Gouda that comes out of, like, the red wax wrapper is, like, a little bit sweet.
Mm-hmm.
If you get to, like, a five-year-aged Gouda, like, Unikas is a brand of that, it is so sweet, it's basically dessert.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, aging does a lot to, like, change and bring out flavors that might be more hidden
yeah.
when, like, you taste a lot more of the milk than, yeah. like, the underlying qualities.
Mm-hmm.
So, staying in line with Liz Thorpe, I wanted to let you know the gateways that she identifies are going to be cheeses that most people have probably heard of,
mm-hmm.
maybe tasted. Mozzarella, brie, Havarti, Taleggio, Manchego, cheddar, Swiss, Parmesan, blue, and then what she calls the misfits.
Okay.
Which are like, they defy categorization. And like two that I love, Casatica de Buffalo and Shabishu, are in the misfits category,
which is
fantastic. The texture is going to be important.
Mm-hmm.
Like waxy or granular from like a Parmesan or mm-hmm. Beemster extra aged Gouda, or smooth and pudgy like Havarti. I have described cheese texture in my spreadsheet as creamy, firm, smooth, crumbly, dense, sticky, cakey, pillowy, chewy, and melty.
Interesting.
The flavor that you're going to pick up on, there's so many. There are flavor and aroma wheels that you can find online, and you can identify, like, where does my cheese lie on this flavor wheel? So the categories that you'll find on that will be lactic, meaning, like, a dairy or, like, milky flavor, fruity, vegetable, fungus, herb, animal, other food. I've described cheese as potato-y.
Okay.
You might taste spices or atmospherics. Like, I've described a cheese as barny.
Okay.
I've described cheese flavors and scents as, like, grassy, milky, sour, sweet, earthy, acidic, sheepy.
Okay.
Mushroomy, buttery, oniony. There was a cheese that I ate that I said, this tastes like broccoli and cheese soup.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like, the cheese itself. Mm-hmm. So, like, there are so many things to choose from. You don't have to eat barnyardy cheeses. I promise.
So you don't like it. try a different one.
Yes,
there's
exactly.
There's so many kinds.
Yeah. Yep. And so then, like, the outside of the cheese is going to affect, like, the way you enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Some cheeses are thick and waxy. Some are thin. Some are creamy. Some come in wooden rinds.
Mm-hmm.
Some come in grape leaves. Some look like brains. Some are brightly colored. You should be looking at, like, the rind or the outside of the cheese that can be thick or thin, the cream line for the bloomies, like brie.
Mm-hmm.
The cream line is, like, a line partway through the cheese that where it's, like, not as much aged, I'll say. Like, so you'll be able to see it the next time you eat. I wish I had one here so I could be like, this is the cream line.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the flavor, the flavor might be a little bit different from the inside to the outside
mm-hmm.
of a brie.
Yeah.
The paste is the edible interior of it. Cheeses might have holes or eyes or openings, like Swiss cheese. There's a fantastic, I'm just thinking of this cheddar that they poke holes in the cheddar while it's aging and inject the mold that's used to make blue cheese.
Oh, interesting.
So it's a cheddar with, like, veins of blue in it.
Interesting.
So huh. Anyway, if you're feeling adventurous, go to the store or a cheese shop, a Whole Foods, anywhere where they sell cheese, and get, like, 3 or 4 or 5 of just the same kind of cheese. This is, like, my, like, best advice about how to taste cheese. Taste them back to back, like, just a little bit at a time. Cut a piece, let it come to room temperature, smell it before you taste it. Look at it before you eat it. When you're eating it, like, breathe in and out while you're chewing, because you'll get different, like, flavor profile or flavor mm-hmm. notes. And maybe be like me and use a notebook or a spreadsheet mm-hmm. and write down, like, what you smelled and tasted and saw. If you're not feeling adventurous, try exactly what you know you like, but from a different brand. Like, if you know you like cheddar from Kraft or Tillamook, try one from Cabot or Kerrygold, which are available at most grocery stores. But either way, like, go try some cheese.
And I will say, if you're like, I don't even know which one to pick. Like, I wouldn't even know, okay, cheddar. Like, do I just pick 4 cheddars?
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I have tried before that's been really fun is, instead of being like, oh, I'm going to spend $16 on a type of cheese I may not like, right? I have done the rule of the old wedding adage. So something old, something new, something goat, and something blue. And I think this is a great way if you are like me and you're like, I don't even know where to start. Or like I was at least a few years ago, like, I don't even know what my favorite cheese would be. So this is what I would do on my grocery store run. I'd get an old cheese.
Mm-hmm.
So something that said the word aged on it. I think that if it doesn't say the word aged, it's new. That's my understanding. Like, if it doesn't say it's been aged, it hasn't been aged. So something old means something that says aged, like 2 years, 5 years, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Something new, so just anything that looks good, looks pretty, looks delicious. You heard about it in an ad once. You heard about it on this podcast, whatever that is. Something new. Something goat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really easy to find. Like, it's really easy to find goat. And if you want to substitute cheap, go for it. But I think this is a great way to get, like, that whole group of milk cheeses in by prioritizing. Make sure you find, like, a goat or a sheep or a buffalo mm-hmm. or something like that. And then something blue. Like, try the funky. Even if you're like me and you're not sure you're going to like the funky, try it. So if you don't even know where to start, if you're like, I can't even pick one to grab, like, 5 cheeses for, do something old, something new, something goat, something blue.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good way to start off.
I totally advocate for that approach. I'll say, so, like, I read a few books, and they will all be in the show notes. But in reading that book, American Cheese by Joe Berkowitz, I read this as the story of how he became a cheese snob, but through my learning process, I really became a cheese omnivore.
Okay.
I have not developed the idea that there are good cheeses and bad cheeses, or
mm-hmm.
that, like, you should only like expensive cheeses, or that you should only like cheeses that are made in small batches.
Mm-hmm.
Like, cheese is all good. And to that end, vegan cheese, like, if you want to try, like, there are vegan cheese options available in a lot of places now. And if lactose doesn't agree with you, or if you are vegan, try some of the new vegan cheeses. I have tried some. And yeah, it's cheap. Like, cheese is cheese. It's wonderful. Eat more of it.
This is the one other thing I wanted to bring up, is that I think cheese is really accessible. I've said that several times mm-hmm. now, but I also think it's really accessible across different dietary restrictions. So if you eat halal, if you eat kosher, if you are vegan, like whatever that may be, there's a cheese for you, which I think is really cool. It may not be available at your local convenience store or something like that, but if you have a grocer, you will probably be able to find like some kind of option. And that's really beautiful. Like, it's very hard to think of a type of food that we have all the options available for. That's not a basic part of our human story, right? Like, bread is a basic part of our human story, and we've gotten so much better at having options for people who are gluten-free or celiac or things like that. Cheese is the same way. And I really love that idea that, like, there's some universal, like, bread and cheese that we all kind of share, that in every culture we have some variety of this, and every person can have access, well, not have access, but every person could find this. And so if you're looking for a particular kind of cheese, if you want a recommendation, if you are wondering what a particular cheese has been like on Jennifer's spreadsheet, email Jennifer. Don't email me. If you email me, I'm going to email you back and say, try email something Jennifer. Old, something new, something goat and something blue, or email Jennifer. But I do think that it is a really beautiful world to jump into. If you want to jump into it fully, Jennifer can help you with that. And if you just want to be a little bit more adventurous, like, I knew very little about cheese before today. I still know far less than Jennifer does, and it's still an incredible thing to get to share with others, right? Yes. So even if you are not a cheese snob or a cheese omnivore, if you are like me and you're slowly building your repertoire, you're not alone. It's a wonderful thing that brings us all together, and we would love to hear more about your favorite kind of cheese. So if you could email us that at fascinatingordinary@gmail.com, or let us know on Instagram or Facebook. Follow us on Patreon. Comment there. Let us know what your favorite types of cheese have been so that Jennifer can add it to her list and try it someday. We would really love that.
And thank you for listening.
Welcome to the show. I'm Abby Jorgensen.
Okay. I'm Abby Jorgensen. I see an Easter egg in our future.
All right, let's try this again with the right names.